and welcome to the Every Movie Ever podcast. My name is Ben Gross.
And my name is Rob McFarlane. Welcome to the show, a movie podcast slash mental health check-in for two broken-brained best friends talking around their problems, but not about their problems.
Never.
Whilst last-minute movies. So, Ben, before we get to what we're doing, just briefly, let's ask the more important question. Mm-hmm. How are you doing, bud?
I'm a bit ill. I've got the spicy eyes and the back of the nose and throat is like prickly.
Right.
That's upsetting. I've got a bit of grey brain and I don't know why, man.
And you say a bit of grey brain. You've been an absolute bastard to me for the whole week.
So
I've just been
sorry.
Like, what about this? And you're like, yeah, could do. I mean, what's it matter? What does anything matter? You don't.
That's all not right, what mate. I've been saying at all. I've been saying love you every night and I rarely get one back and that's very upsetting.
That's just because I'm that is bad and I'm trying to work on that. It's not because I don't feel it, it's just because I see it and I'm like, oh, he's gone.
Let's work on it now. I love you.
Love you. I love you.
All right.
For new listeners, we're not a couple, we're just best mates. But yeah. I love you, dude.
Man wives. Honestly though, I've got nothing to grumble about. I'm really happy in my jobs. I'm really happy at home. I'm happy seeing all my family. This weekend was mint. Mm-hmm. We just had the quiz at the Boardroom Gaming Cafe. That went incredible.
That did go really well.
Yeah, I've got nothing to grumble about. I'm just being a mopey bell end.
Could it be that you've got nothing to grumble about and that is really upsetting? Because you love a grumble.
I love a grumble.
And maybe now that there's nothing to grumble about.
Yeah.
You're not dating Hitler. You're not working in hell. Right? You haven't got a collapsed lung. And so all you've got left is yourself.
That's so
and you're still not happy. And you're just going, oh, I can't blame her. I can't blame the job. I can't blame my lung. I can't blame this. It's just me.
Yeah, I'm just a dick. I get all of my fun stuff from negative situations that I'm in. And I'm like, yeah, but isn't this hilarious?
Right.
As a way of dealing with it. But then when there's nothing to deal with, I'm like, where's my comedy?
You're alone in the room with yourself just going, oh God, the problem has always and will always be me.
Oh God, this is lovely. What a lovely time I'm having. This green tea is delicious. I'm healthy. Let's watch a very entertaining film. Yeah, great. All right. I've got friends around me that love and support me no matter what. All right. Brilliant.
It's heartbreaking.
It's horrible. I don't understand it, man. Brains make no sense to me. Humans are messed up, weird animals.
It's almost like you've got depression.
How are you, buddy?
Yeah, I find this time of year hard. I always look back on the year and I'm like, what have I achieved? What's changed? I've caught myself as well because last year, 2023, we covered Nolan and that did gangbusters. We went from a small show to a low end of medium show and I was like, wow.
Lower middle class show, yeah.
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 And I was like, oh, that's exciting. And then it died off and we're like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Because next little bounce we get, it'll be an order of magnitude bigger because we're now bigger than we were.
Sure.
And I've just been waiting all year and it hasn't happened. And we've had a couple things. We'll get into it. I'm in a reflective place and I'm like, what have we achieved this year? Have we achieved anything?
Maybe that's what I need to look at. You know what I mean? Maybe I need to start being more reflective. Maybe that's where the comedy's hiding.
Yeah, mate, 100%.
Yeah.
Now, Ben, not everyone likes everything.
They don't. Blue cheese.
The Offspring.
Offspring are mint. Breast implants.
Yeah, no, they're not. And breast, yeah, fine. Pineapple on pizza.
Pineapple. There you go.
There we go. If you, dear listener, hear a cried pineapple, just a short bit of the chat that might not be to everyone's taste and is less about the film than, say, a brand new listener might need. But not to worry, the full spicy Hawaiian version of every episode is available over on Patreon days beforehand with all the pineapple you could ever want for just £1 a month.
It's a quid.
Right.
It's literally a quid.
Right. Yeah. Likewise, our potty mouths are going to be censored in this version. But you can hear all the bad words you like over on Patreon.
Like
poo poo caca wee wee.
Like there it is. That's the one.
What's upsetting is that that's one of your favorite bits of the show. It doesn't matter what we're talking about. No matter how what cinematic gem we bring.
Yeah.
You just like, I'm gonna say the C word and it's gonna be great.
It's brightened my day.
What are we doing this week?
We're tuning back into the David Fincherverse with my dear baby faced angel.
Oh,
the girl with the dragon tattoo. Why are we doing this, Rob? Is it just because we're covering every Fincher movie ever?
Yeah, partly that, but also for various reasons. Like I mentioned earlier, we're sitting on a bunch of stuff that has not happened in the time frame that we'd hoped.
Yeah.
A bunch of stuff that fell flat on its face. This week's reel that we were both quite excited about. Saw it seen by about 12 people, liked by none of them.
It's about 2 hours worth of editing those.
Right, yeah. You know and I mean? It's kind of I'm in a little bit of like a are we failing at this? Now I'm sure you, dear listener, have got some stuff going on that feels like it's failing. It's winter, it's drawing in, the year's coming to a close, the evenings are getting shorter.
It's dark at 3 PM. Everyone's right, failing at everything. Right. You know what I mean?
And like we're all and look, in Fincher's career, I would argue there is no bigger failure than this trilogy of films. Because Alien 3 is divisive, sure, but it's also his first film.
Yeah, it's also objectively
it's brilliant. It's my favourite Alien movie. But like you can forgive him having a trip mm-hmm. and a stumble, especially with everything we covered. When we covered Alien 3, sure. Everything going on.
Yeah.
But this is Fincher at his creative peak. Mm-hmm. He is king of the mountain. It's an incredible cast, and it's an adaptation of one of the most popular books in the world at the time.
Yeah.
And of the three planned films, this is the only one that exists. So,
the crime.
In an attempt to make us feel better, and hopefully you, dear listener, feel better, we're going to talk about how Fincher dealt with this failure, or like her boss.
Okay, I'm down for this.
It's dealing with failure 101, Fincher School.
Okay, and Fincher famously has struggled with this in the past.
Yeah, exactly. So, we've got a lot to get into this week.
Fincher's MCU alternative.
The multiple subplots of this complex film. And how they all point us to the loneliest place on the planet.
Rooney Mara's insanity.
Why David Fincher makes Benjamin Kenneth Groves very nervous.
It's not Kenneth.
He is, stop denying.
And how the failure of this movie might be the help that we all need.
But before we get into all that, Ben, there's a very important question that we need to ask.
Where'd that man been? Where Fincher at? How Fincher are?
Right, well, it's an interesting one because we covered The Social Network not too long ago.
We did.
That came out in spring of 2010. This was released in December of 2011.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, whoa, that's fast. Okay.
Yeah.
For a Fincher film, that's fast.
He was finishing up The Social Network.
Right.
And ramping up production on this.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a huge crossover between the two, but he's not sat and had a rest. Okay. Let's put it that way.
Okay, okay.
Ben, remind us, what was going on in 2011?
Let me take you back, my dear boy. Let me, come join me. Come sit next to Papa Ben.
Making it weird.
On the sleigh of mystery. Let's take a right. Let's take a sonder, eh? It's 2011.
I hate this.
It's 2011.
Right,
and
is
the Southern Hemisphere gets a bad case of the shakes. Leading to a near total destruction of Christchurch, New Zealand. I did not think that you were going to take it this way. Fair. And the birth of this timeline's Godzilla in Fukushima, Japan.
Yeah.
Wow.
Come on. It was
a
shaky, quaky time. Half the world got Parkinson's. What? Like, how else was I supposed to put it?
Wow.
That's the other route I was going to go down.
Yeah. No, it's good. That's good. The end of tuna. Could have been another one. Also, is tuna fixed now? Because I remember, like, after Fukushima, we couldn't eat tuna anymore.
Sorry. Can't eat what?
Tuna.
Tuna?
Tuna.
Are you American?
What do you mean?
Tuna.
Tuna?
Yeah.
All right, fine.
Tuna?
Tuna. I've always called it tuna.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, now the shoe's on the other foot. How the turns table.
I know why I do this. I used to call it... I called it tuna in Japan once, and the word for kiss... in Japanese is chew, and it's like quite cutesy. And people used to take the piss out of me being sort of like, stop trying to sound cute, just say Tuesday. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, yeah. My bad.
All right, no, we're British, mate. It's Tuesday, isn't it?
Tuesday.
It's tuna.
If you're not spitting.
Here's a can of tuna, I'll stick it on my lambooner.
Dislocate your bottom jaw, throw the top teeth out.
Yeah.
That's how you pronounce a Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 2011, my dear boy.
Oh, good, yeah, of course.
The world rejoices as we finally rid ourselves of some truly awful people. Bin Laden, Gaddafi, and the news of the world all get what they deserve. I love that you laughed at your own joke.
It was your delivery.
And they are mourned by no one. It's 2011, my dear boy.
Uh-huh.
Self-confessed warlock, Charlie Sheen, is pie-winning on Tiger Blood.
Yeah.
To quote the man himself, the run he is on makes Sinatra, Jagger, Richards, all of them, look like droopy-eyed harmless children.
What a quote. Honestly, that interview is one of my favourite pieces of media that exists.
The guy's a legend.
He really is.
I love him so much. It's 2011, my dear boy, and David Fincher is given $90 million to make The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. $90 million.
Yeah. 90 mil. It's a cool 90 mil.
That's impressive. I guess Sweden, expensive, right?
Well, we'll get into why Sweden's expensive. Okay. But before we do, for those of you that haven't seen this film in a long while and want a bit of a refresher so you know what the hell we're talking about later in the episode, or those of you who've got no plans on seeing this film and just want to hang out with us, we're going to give you a quick little breakdown of what happens in the movie. Consider it a spoiler warning. This film's been out a while, and we're going to tell you exactly what happens. It's only 2 minutes, but it's kind of important to what we've got going on later, all right?
You've had 14 years to watch a film. Are you really going to spoil it for 2 minutes? You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Just play the jingle. We're having a breakdown. Journalist Michael Blomqvist faces a career crisis after losing a libel case against a powerful businessman, Wennerström. Shortly after, he is approached by Henrik Wanger, the head of a wealthy Swedish family, with an unusual request to investigate the decades-old disappearance of Henrik's niece, Harriet, who vanished from the family estate in 1966.
What?
Henrik believes a member of his family is responsible and offers Mikael both payment and information that could help him take revenge on Wennerström.
Oh.
So he's had his career ruined by a guy who probably did it, but there's no proof he's did it. And this old dude's been like, a member of my family definitely killed my niece. And what's more than that, the killer sends me a pressed flower every year to taunt me that I know that she was murdered. And it has to be someone on this little island, this little family island. It has to be my family member. Find out, and I'll give you the goods on your man, Wennerström.
Mikael moves to the remote Wanger estate and begins unraveling the complex web of family relationships. With little progress made, he enlists the help of Lisbeth Salander, a brilliant hacker with a troubled past who had previously investigated him for Henrik. Together, they uncover a series of brutal murders spanning decades, all connected to Bible verses. The investigation points to Martin Wanger, Henrik's nephew, as the perpetrator, and Mikael confronts him. Martin captures and tortures Mikael, but is stopped by Lisbeth, who rescues him in a violent showdown. Fuck my life. Martin flees and dies in a car crash during his escape.
The pair continues digging and discovers that Harriet is alive, living under a new identity in London. She reveals her disappearance was an escape from her abusive brother Martin and her father, who had also subjected her to years of violence. With Harriet's help, Mikael brings closure to the Wanger family mystery. Meanwhile, Lisbeth uses her skills to gather evidence against Wennerström, helping Mikael publish a damning expose that restores his reputation.
The film concludes with Lisbeth preparing to express her feelings for Mikael, but she finds him reconnecting with his old flame, Erica Berger. Is Berger her real last name?
Berger.
Oh, yeah, makes sense. Finds him reconnecting with his old flame, Erica Berger. I prefer Berger. Heartbroken, she discards the gift she had planned to give him and rides away on her Michael cycle.
Oh my God, Ben.
And rides away on her motorcycle, leaving Mikael unaware of her departure. That was a nightmare. I apologize. Mm.
So, given that this is the first of a trilogy and, you know, we're all excited to see where it leads. Haha.
Yeah.
More fool us. When did you first watch this film? What was your thoughts? What was your feelings?
Okay.
Because this wasn't one you dug in it. This is one that I'm like, I was dugging in. I was like, let me chomp on this as soon as it came out because Nine Inch Nails did the soundtrack.
Also,
this was a first time watch for you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All me.
So I've not watched this because it was a popular book and I'm like, meh.
Right.
Meh. You know what I mean? Like I've been tricked into this before. I watched Harry Potter in the cinema. I'm not falling for this again. So I ignored it.
Right, okay.
Forgot it existed. Yep. And then we did the Fincher series.
Yeah.
And you were like, next week is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I was like, yeah, I'm in. So
great.
I left it until 2 days ago to watch it.
How'd you find it?
Probably the most harrowing 3 hours I've spent in a long time, especially with a little bit of grey brain.
Yeah.
Here's a little flash warning for anyone that's having like, not an off day, but you know, just sort of like a meh kind of day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grey brain.
Yeah, yeah. Just don't watch Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
No.
That shouldn't be your go-to. If it is, get help.
No.
Medical help. Immediately. Professional help. Because Step Brothers exists. You know what I mean? Anything else exists. Just watch anything else. I watched it. I loved it. I hated it. It was aggressively
cynical and dark,
cynical, torturous, mean-spirited, and just there is some elements of evil that are in this film that are so hard to comprehend in the moment that it's happening, because it's such a well-paced film.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't dwell on the evil too long. It snap happens, and then you have to deal with it whilst processing the rest of the stuff that's going on, as the characters would have to in their normal day-to-day lives.
Yeah,
and the way that it's done is genius, but awful, because it leaves you hanging like, what? Oh, no, I don't want to see grocery shopping now.
Right.
I don't want to see this.
Right, but they've got to do it. They need milk.
Yeah. Right. Dude, it's incredible. The way that it's done is literally, this is probably up to date. To date, this is Fincher's best film. By a long shot.
In his catalogue, I would agree.
Yeah,
I would
by
agree.
A long shot.
It is a perfection of the serial killer mystery thriller that he has been working on since Seven. It's Seven. There's an interesting... I wasn't meant to be talking about this. It's a total tangent. But Fincher's early career is really hot.
Yeah.
And his late career is really cold.
Yes.
And for me, this is his coldest. Like, Fight Club and Seven, it's all dirt and bright colours and like vivid greens and vivid pinks and fast edits and like up tempo soundtracks, be like, oh, it's so 90s and tubular and extreme.
Did you just say tubular?
Yeah. That's lean into it.
Yeah, sorry. I've never heard you say that word in 18 years of knowing you. That's incredible.
Yeah, because it's not the 90s anymore. No one says tubular anymore. I was using it as an era signifier.
I'm going to make that my ringtone. You know what I mean? That's going to be my ringtone for the rest of my life.
No, it's your ring tuner.
My ring tune. My ring tuner.
Yeah. So his later films, Social Network, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and Gone Girl, are frozen. This is the most frozen of the three.
I'm going to disagree. I feel like this is this is on par with Gone Girl for me. I think it's a different race, though.
Right.
This one, you're removed and you're from the outside looking in. Gone Girl, you're very much involved with. It's first person. It's happening to you. It's this, but it's much more intimate.
Yes. Sorry, can I just clarify? When you say this is a different race, you mean Olympics and not Al Jolson?
I do mean that, yes. I was going to say ball game because I've been playing lots of MLB baseball.
Ball game would have been better.
Yeah.
Okay. We're a podcast, Ben. We have to remember our company.
Oh, I see my issue.
Yeah. It's a savagely cold, cynical, dark film. And I love it for that because it's essentially... It's a superhero film. I'm going to come back to why it's a superhero film, both figuratively and literally.
Please do.
Yeah, I will. I promise I will. But I think the thing I want to come back to very briefly before I do is that whole concept of it. We're at the end of the year. The evenings are getting shorter. Nights are drawing in.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a bit reflective and a bit like, oh, you know, how's the year been? This has been a slightly rough one for us in lots of ways. It's been great in lots of ways. But it's also been, if we're talking about failures or like things that you could frame as failures.
Okay. Yeah,
we've had some stuff going on, right? Like we consciously uncoupled from YouTube.
We did,
to put it in Chris Martin and Gwyneth Paltrow terms.
Yeah, hated that, but yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple of like things that we've just gone, do you know what? That's not for us.
I think it's a smart move for now. Like they will be for us, but for right now, they can't be because we tried
really hard is what I'm pointing at, and we're not seeing the return that we need, and that's been kind of true of a lot of things this year. I mean, I don't know about you. Right,
I came into this year, I left a very stable job, a very well-paid stable job.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't happy. It was a sit-down office job. It was fine. The people I worked with were fine. I was hitting quarterly targets within a week, so then I had well over 2 months of sort of twiddling my thumbs. So I left that because I thought, what better job to do in the winter than be a postman?
Mm-hmm.
Wearing shorts, knobbing about, chatting to people. There's your Christmas prezi. Enjoy your day, right?
I think that's the sort of version of what a postman is that can only come from Postman Pat and then never investigating further.
Yeah, Postman Pat and then that one guy from... What's that Ricky Gervais?
Afterlife.
Afterlife. Yeah, that's it. That's the one. Yeah, that was my entire inspiration for that job switch.
Brilliant.
Anyway, the job fell through for no reason. They just stopped emailing me back. So I'd left my job and was like, hey, so I'd done my induction, all of this stuff. And then that just all fell through. And I was like, oh, cool. And they were like, yeah, yeah, we didn't tell you that you were to start. Yeah. I was like, you gave me a start date and an induction.
Yeah.
Great. Then shortly after that, I had a relationship, failed.
Yeah.
Went through a breakup. That was pretty savage because it was one of those relationships where you, I mean, I'm not going to speak for anyone else, but I got all of my self-worth from that. I sort of had that as part of my identity.
Yeah, you totally codependented.
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah, that was, it was the most codependent situation I've ever been a part of. And it got to a point where I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I liked. I didn't do stuff that I was interested in. It was just going through the motions because it was comfortable and familiar and easy.
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't nice to come to terms with because sort of once you break away from this, I really had to sit and stare in the mirror and go, wow, this ain't who I thought I would be looking at right now.
I mean anyone who wants to know my litany of failures, go listen to last week's episode on A Different Man, where I, for the first time probably ever on the show, well, probably since Green Room, like, opened up about how I was and what I was doing, and it was terrifying and awful and blah. It's just been a rough year, right? We've had stuff going on that feels failure-y.
Yeah.
But here's why I think this week
is
perfect to do Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
Okay. Because
we're covering it in the same month that the film is set, and I think there's some valuable lessons about how we're feeling in this film. Not intentionally. Don't get me wrong. We're covering every David Fincher film ever, but by some miracle, it has, the chips have fallen in this beautiful way. So let me give you some context. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you said, you know, it's based on a book.
Yeah.
That book sold more than 30 million copies.
Jesus Christ.
It was then made into a film starring Noomi Rapace in Swedish language. They were worldwide total gross of 100 million.
Wow.
For that first film.
Respect.
They said, US studios, they had this concept, right? So this is David Fincher quoting. David Fincher says, I was offered Dragon Tattoo long before the first movie, the 2009 one, was made.
Yeah.
And I was in the middle of something else.
Right.
Also, I was like, lesbian hacker on a motorcycle. I don't think so.
Yeah, fair.
He goes, I wasn't that interested in the notion of making another serial killer movie. As much as the studio was committed to the idea of a hard R rated adult franchise.
I'm glad that gap between hard R and rated franchise was deafening. That was outrageous. I was like, where is this one going? Because I've just mistakenly said race instead of ball game. You can't be dropping hard R in the middle of an episode now.
He went on and he goes, look, there's a very large talent pool of people who don't feel that there's much for them in terms of sustenance working for Marvel.
Okay, that's understandable.
And I think if we can make a playground for them that is thoughtful, adult, interesting, complex, challenging, there's a chance at something that isn't lassoed and hogtied by three-act structure.
Okay. I can get
so
behind
that. So in a sort of bizarre way, this was a sort of adult version of the MCU.
Okay. I can see that, man.
Lisbeth is a kind of grounded in reality revenge tale superhero who doesn't turn herself into... Like, serious, genuine things happen to these people.
Yeah.
And they react as we would want ourselves to, as we would like to think we would react if we had film character levels of not giving a damn, right?
Hack into a newspaper and then murder a bunch of people, yeah.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. Seeing injustice, getting it fixed.
Yeah.
A brilliant, brilliant, sort of incredibly satisfying thing to watch. It's a harrowing thing to see why they've got to do those things.
Yeah. Also really inspirational though, because, you know what I mean, I struggle with Excel, so.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
So as a character, she's brilliant, and she's a brilliant kind of like Captain Sweden.
Captain Sweden.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's a ridiculous comparison that I'm ashamed to make, but I feel like there are some movie podcasts out there that you and I talk about that we will not name.
Smooth.
That have gone down the Marvel route.
Okay.
And we often talk about, well, they're doing really well. They're doing really, really well. Should we do that? And we go... Nah.
No.
We're not Marvel, man. We're not doing that.
No. We're not even DC. I think we're like, we're Image or we're Dark Horse at best.
I think that's what we're, but I'm talking about what we're trying to be. They're trying to be everything for every person Here's a movie fact. Did you know that film isn't real?
Oh, my God.
The actors are pretending.
Yeah, that's a great insight.
And then the other person goes, oh, my God, really? And we're like, oh, come on.
Okay.
Or there's like, did you know Jeff Goldblum, before he was on Marvel, he was in The Fly? Wow. Oh, my God, really? He was also in Jurassic Park. Oh, yeah, of course.
Did you know that before she was an actress, Sigourney Weaver was a baby?
Oh, my God, really? Right, so there's that. Yeah. And it's super successful and it works.
It's great.
And so it's a ridiculous comparison, but I can kind of understand the impetus to go, I see what's happening over there,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think I could bring myself to do that.
No.
But what if we took the good and we did an adult, interesting, slightly more challenging, slightly more thoughtful version?
Okay.
And I think that's what this was going to be. They spent a huge amount of money on it.
Okay.
So this was, let's get David Fincher, let's get the most popular book on the planet, and let's get an incredible cast, and let's make a franchise that operates like the MCU.
I love this.
But it's for grown-ups.
I love this.
What a brilliant idea, right?
It kind of feeds into, like, I've got a note here saying multiple storylines and what they represent. That's the tagline for it, right?
Give me this note. Tell me what it is.
So this note, you've got so many different branches of film under one umbrella in this, right?
Right.
You've got the murder mystery, which turns into like a big serial killer hunt.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the ruined identity of the investigative journalist and how that has the potential to be resolved.
He's had his reputation destroyed and exactly. He's got one last Hail Mary chance to get his identity back.
His credential back, right? And then, also that he's got like a little carrot on the end of a stick, like dangling in front of him, that's sort of tempting him to do these certain things. It's incredible. But you've also got this outrageously upsetting storyline of Lisbeth's situation and how she is actively isolated, manipulated,
ripped,
taken advantage of, is how I've worded it, but you are not incorrect.
It's one of the most harrowing scenes I've seen in a 2000s era movie.
She's just fucking outright abused in every single situation. Yeah. And it's especially done
mm-hmm.
by the people and the powers that are there to protect her. Now, if that doesn't spell out the foundation of an adult MCU universe
without superheroes,
I don't know what does. Because that is like...
Well, what's fantastic about her as a character is that she has these awful things happen to her. And she is a victim, but she never allows herself to be victimized.
Yeah.
And the people that do, she gets back at and goes, I think fucking not, Sunshine.
Yeah. She's she's bang at it.
Right. It's interesting because the original title of the book in Swedish mm-hmm. is Men Who Hate Women.
I like that better.
Right.
I just half wanted you to say the girl with the dragon tattoo in a really bad Swedish accent. But that's the childish version of me. You know what I mean? We're here to grow.
Yeah. Right. Of course. What's terrifying and beautiful about this film, it's not a three-act structure.
It's not.
Like, subplots are resolved in the first third of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
And the main characters don't meet until halfway through.
Yeah.
For the first half of this film, you're watching two separate films side by side.
You are. And they're both as fucked up as each other.
Yeah, they really are. Yeah. They really are. I'm just going to come out and say it. We're not going to talk about what I would call the main theme of this, which is violence against women.
Okay.
Because A, it makes for a really difficult to listen to episode.
Yep.
And B, I don't think we're the people whose opinion really matters on this one.
I'm going to agree with you. I think two white males on a podcast are arguably overqualified. We don't need that again.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
You don't need two white guys to talk to fix all the reasons that there's sexual violence against women. Not again. Can't be us every time.
Not for a third time. You know what I mean?
For our American listeners, we're being ironic.
That is pure sarcasm, actual joke. Context is lol.
Right, yeah. We're leaning into the awfulness of other podcasts who go, let me tell you what I think about sexual violence against women. We're just not qualified.
Yeah.
Right? We've never been victim to it and we've never committed any. So what do we know about it?
We can't patronise and be sort of like, I know where you're coming from.
Right, yeah. We just don't.
We don't. There's no way.
But that is kind of a huge theme in it.
I'm okay.
But I think what makes it excellent is it's never exploitative.
It's not.
It's never voyeuristic. It's never sexy.
No.
And it's righted by a woman on her own terms mm-hmm. without any help from any male character.
Yep.
Daniel Craig's character in this doesn't fix her issues for her. She fixes them and then she comes help him.
Yeah. She fixes his issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, every time he has an issue, she fixes it. And then if he's having a bit of an issue, she takes precautions to make sure it doesn't happen again. And it's like, I might be in love. Like, I'm just saying.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Lisbeth Salander in this film is goals.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Unreal.
She looks, I mean, she's your perfect woman. She looks like a heroin addicted alien.
Yeah.
And she's got autism.
She is. And
she's hella riddled with autism.
She is. She's got a touch of the tism. You know what I mean? There's a smidge.
Riddled. Absolutely riddled.
There's a smidge. Okay. I can see this. But talking about Rooney Mara, I've only just clicked in this exact moment right now,
mm-hmm.
was in The Social Network.
She was. So get this. David Fincher worked with her for 4 days on The Social Network.
Right.
And when she heard that he was making Dragon Tattoo, she was desperate for it.
Okay.
She really, really wanted to do it. And he was like, no, she's like the clean cut, all American girl. Because in his head,
yeah.
he had her as Erica Albright, her character in mm-hmm. The Social Network. So she campaigned and she campaigned, and she campaigned. And eventually she managed to get a test screening.
Yeah.
She had to convince David, which took like 3 or 4 screen tests. And then once he was convinced, he had to convince the studio. So it ended up taking about 6 or 7 months of her turning up, getting into character, getting dressed up, doing screen tests, getting photos taken, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. At one point, she was booked to do promo for The Social Network.
Yeah.
And the production company rang her and they're like, you need to come in to screen test. She's like, I can't. I've got to go to Europe for Elle magazine.
Yeah.
And they're like, yep. Just tell them you got food poisoning. She's like, I mean, in my head, I was going, they either want you or they don't, and they should just fuck off at this point.
Yeah.
But of course, I went anyway because I wanted the part.
Sound. So
she, haircut, obviously, mm-hmm. that's real. Bleached her eyebrows, kept them bleached for the duration of filming.
Incredible.
Lost an unhealthy amount of weight.
Yeah.
But the piercings are real. Okay. Eyebrow piercings, real. The nipple piercings, real. Because she wanted... She said that when, because there's so much nudity in the film, she felt like she was more comfortable if she had all the piercings because it meant even when she was naked, she was still in costume.
That's interesting.
She's not, it's not Rooney Mara naked on screen.
Right.
Because Rooney Mara doesn't have piercings.
Right, yeah.
She then went...
that's cool.
Martial arts training.
Okay.
She went motorcycle training. She got a dialect coach to get the accent.
Okay.
And she also, weirdly... learned to skateboard.
To skateboard?
Yes.
Does she skateboard in this film?
No, not once.
Okay.
David Fincher said she's a bit androgynous and she's got kind of arrested development. You know, she's 24 in the film, but she is mentally much younger than that. She's not as mature as that.
Right.
And she's a bit of a misfit. So I want her to have the walk of a 13-year-old boy. So you're going to learn how to skateboard and get your weight all weird and just do something a 13-year-old boy does. So she learned to skateboard so she could get in so much of the behind-the-scenes footage, he's like, do the skateboard thing and you'll see her posture change. And he's like, yeah, mint.
My favourite thing about that fact is that Fincher at some point saw a 13-year-old boy skating and was like, that's the posture. That's the posture that
yeah.
she needs.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I want for my film. So wildly
but
specific.
Can you imagine, like, you're just there like learning to skateboard going, I just want to be in a film, man.
Yeah, but can you imagine being on a skate park and someone being like, mm-hmm. why are you in The Social Network, why are you learning to skateboard? Just like, yeah shut the fuck up, I'm trying to be a Swedish badass.
The worst thing is, after all of that, do you want to hear what David Fincher said?
Go on.
It is savage.
Okay.
He just said, and this is, I quote David Fincher, mm-hmm. yeah, piercings are piercings and losing weight is losing weight. I think that's important to maybe the Golden Globes. It's not so important to me.
After all that effort.
For me, it's about, is the person willing to do the work on themselves to understand this character? Which saves the quote a bit.
Say, Jesus Christ, that's a massive U-turn at the end. Why did you leave that pause? Your pauses today are out of pocket, man. We need to talk about this. Jesus.
But I love the idea that he's just sending her on random quests.
I love that.
Oh, you want the part? Cool. Go climb that mountain and ask the guy at the top.
Yeah. Oh, what, you want
3 riddles.
You want to be a 24-year-old Swedish badass? Get in a knife fight with a smackhead in Stockholm.
Right. You can begin to see why this cost 90 million.
Yeah.
Not to mention, it was shot in Sweden, so the days are incredibly short.
Oh my, yeah, okay.
So fair. The daytime shots.
Yeah.
They had very little time to film them. So something that would take a day to film in Atlanta
mm-hmm.
takes 3 in Sweden.
That's nutty.
because you just haven't got the light for that long. Like it was a insanely long shooting schedule. It was like 160 days of primary
Jesus
photography.
Christ.
Yeah. And it was purely because of the location.
That's insane. Yeah. 160 days is insane.
With David Fincher though, and everything's got to be done 90 times.
Yeah, but most of his films are like 40, 50 days and everyone's like, Jesus Christ, that was exhausting. This is literally three times that amount.
Fair but play. I mean, look, the setting's important. I get it. It you is. Know, and I'm glad he went there.
Dude, the setting, this is another one of my notes, the setting and the location. Like, I can't get over how the film feels. You know, this really like knobby thing that people say where it's like, oh God, New York City is just a character in itself.
Yes, I do, 100%.
Dude, this entire backdrop is a living, breathing, talking, definitely loud character in this film. It's so upsetting. Like, I can't even put my finger on why. It's like it is a it's a desolate, desperately lonely backdrop, right? Of this tiny little remote island in the 100%. Middle of Sweden. Now that's harrowing. That's eerie enough, right?
Yeah, all on its own. Yeah.
But then with the two main characters, Mikhail and Lisbeth, bringing some of the most fucked up trauma that you've ever heard with them. This little murder island becomes just paralyzing with fear. Mm-hmm. It is just, it's electric. The whole thing is edge of your seat kind of stuff. It's just the perfect backdrop, man. It's a perfect backdrop for like a noir mystery doused in personal and professional fucked uppery.
What I love about what Finch has done is, even if you look at something as simple as the title of the original book, Men Who Hate Women, he's taken Michael Blomqvist's flaws and brought them right to the front. He was married and he cheated on his wife with his editor, who he then cheats on with his assistant.
Yeah, it's not great. It's not great.
It's a dysfunction and snow and just cold, cynical beauty.
Yeah,
and I think that's the thing is it's the beauty of the desolation because it's a relief from the human stuff.
That's exactly what it is. If anxiety had a front garden, that would be it. It's gorgeous.
Right. Right. Now, we normally do this at the end, but I need to tell you how much this film made now.
Okay.
Because against that 90 million budget, it made 100 million in the US.
That's nothing.
Now, it made 239 million globally, but this was not the massive US hit that they wanted. And for reference, The Avengers, which is kind of what they had the seeds of building, comes out 5 months later and makes a clean 1.5 billion.
Yeah. All right.
Right?
Yeah, I see that though, but I reckon this could have made a billion if you throw an Iron Man in the middle of it. You know what I mean?
So, what this got off the first bat on its first installment that Marvel, I think, really struggles with, this got 5 Academy Award nominations.
Jesus Christ.
And it won for, you know, some of the smaller categories.
Right.
It wasn't what they needed. As far as the studio, they were like, oh, we wanted a bigger hit. But they let him carry on. Progress on the sequel continued.
Okay.
But it's David Fincher.
Yeah, of course.
So he was writing and he was writing. And then in August 2012, so a full 18 months later, there's delays in the script. So July 2013, he gets Andrew Kevin Walker in.
Yeah.
He wrote 7. He signs on to do rewrites, keeps writing, because they're trying to do the next two films back to back.
Okay.
So they're working. And then the fourth book in the series, The Girl and the Spider's Web's released.
Yeah.
And is huge.
Yeah, yeah.
And Sony, who are sick of waiting and want their money and want their this, that, or the other, just clean slate. Just go, we'll start again with The Girl and the Spider's Web.
I saw this on Prime. After I'd finished watching Girl the Dragon Tattoo, this one popped up, an English-speaking language sequel.
We'll come back to that one.
I was like, I don't understand where this is. Where am I?
We will come back to that because I adore this film.
Okay.
I adore these characters. I adore these versions of the characters. The only way I'm going to get what I need is to read the books and picture these characters.
Oh, that sounds fun.
That's all I can do because there will never be a US version. And the Swedish versions are much less David Fincher. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine.
And that's just, you're right. I'm just like, I'm not interested in that.
No, me either.
I love the coldness and the isolation and the David Fincherness of this.
Dude, this, okay. I'm 1,000% with you. 1,000% with you. This is my big thought on this film.
Ooh.
You've led me perfectly to this. So
the main takeaway that I got from this film is the how the story puts a spotlight on loneliness.
Oh, okay.
But then
tell me more.
But then how Fincher really digs the nails in and emphasizes it with his work, and it's sort of like this weird combination of masterful filmmaking.
Yeah.
And disgusting trauma being thrown at you. But it's being handled in a way that you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something in this. And it that's how it starts, and then it just progressively gets weird, right? So
right.
Take the Vanger family, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone's portrayed as like wealthy, successful. But honestly, have you ever seen a group of more actively lonely people in your entire life?
Oh, God, no. They all live on the same island and none of them talk to each other.
They're all surrounded by people, but no one has an ear that they can trust. Like, not one person out there that they can trust. And it's heartbreaking to look at, because I'm like, I can feel for that. Not mm-hmm. having one person to entrust, like, on an entire island, including your family, must be the hardest thing to live with. And you're all just doing it.
Yeah.
In Sweden. In the dark and in the snow. You know what I mean? Yeah, you've got Mikhail.
Yeah, yeah.
So Mikhail is an English guy. He's a journalist whose career has recently been thrown into turmoil. He's got a daughter from a previous marriage.
Mm-hmm.
He is trying to just be, you know what I mean? He's just trying to be him, get his cred back, be a dad.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what it is. Then you've got Lisbeth,
mm-hmm.
ridiculously smart, incredibly resilient. And when I say resilient, I mean just the strongest female character in a movie that we've seen in forever.
Yeah, she's mint.
She's mint.
She's absolutely mint. She's a superhero.
Hella acoustic. I adore her. She's a horrendously abused woman that is not just... She's not just chosen to be isolated. She's forced to be isolated.
It's a safety issue for her.
It's a safety
emotionally,
issue for her.
Physically.
Right. But it's also a non-negotiable situation for her, because her employer, she's weird. People don't like her. She works from home. Yeah. We don't want her in the office, but she's great at what she does.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Her living situation, where she's living in that little rundown little flat. She gets handed an allowance to pay her rent and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Her legal guardian, awful. Awful.
Yeah.
Awful. And it's just...
It's if you've seen the movie Irreversible, this is as bad.
As bad. But not 12 minutes unedited.
Yeah, true.
But it's mainly the lack of trust. It's the lack of trust in her as a functioning adult from a system that's designed to protect her that really, really ruined me. The worst thing about all of this, though, bud, and by a long shot, and we've not mentioned it yet, is Harriet.
Yeah.
She's a background character. She's the focal point of the film, but she is a background character.
She's the MacGuffin. She's the golden idol that Indiana Jones is chasing, right? We've got to find what happened to this girl.
And then you sort of get lost in the mystery of it. But when you really take a step back and you look at it, she's a kid that was forced to flee from like a murderous family on her own to a land that is not her home with no lifeline. She can't risk getting in touch with her family or her friends. Because the chances are that her insanely wealthy, powerful family will track her down and do a murder.
So with all
of this going on, this is sort of like that. There's the isolating factors, the storylines that are all at play constantly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got Fincher. In steps Fincher. You know what I mean? He paints this harrowing picture. It's in gorgeous cinematography. It's a cold blue filter. It instills like
on everything,
and it instills a sense of isolation. And then you've got the soundtrack. Dude, the soundtrack might be the most intense that we've seen on this show of late. Like, The Social Network was great. It was bang at it. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, bang at it. Yeah. Incredible. But this is insane. Like, it's spine chilling. It is this spine chilling, swelling monster. It's riddled with sudden pregnant silence that hits you square in the spine.
Right.
And just disrupts your entire soul on a molecular level.
I've always said, because as we discussed when we covered The Social Network, I'm a massive Nine Inch Nails nerd. They are my one band.
Mm-hmm.
This soundtrack is the sound of like frost forming on a window.
Yes.
It's the coldest, sparsest, but if you put it on loud, put it on your headphones loud, you will have a mental health episode.
Yeah, it's outrageous. Like, honestly, Trent Reznor and Atticus can fuck right off. Like, seriously, they have no right having this much sway over my mental health. They have no right whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is the Grey Day.
You know what I mean? Maybe this explains the grey brain.
Could do.
The worst thing about this whole thing, and the best thing about this whole thing, is Fincher highlights everything with these little tiny throwaway moments and statements that force you to understand the isolation of even the most minor characters. The characters that you never meet, you only hear stories of, but you understand their situation wholeheartedly. I've got an example for this, right? You know the scene where Martin is hosting the dinner for with his missus and Mikhail? And there's a noise off in the distance, and he's like, oh, someone must have left the door
open.
Whatever it is, it's this, that, and the other. And he dips off and he comes back. And it's all played off as like fine and no one suspects a thing. And you forget about it.
Yeah.
Because you're like, it's a non thing. Nothing. It's a bit of wind. Shut up. Who cares? But what it is in actual fact, it's the last moments of life of Martin's latest victim.
Yeah.
And this is then doubled down on when we see the cage in Martin's basement and he casually, in a throwaway thing, goes, yeah, she was in that cage while you were eating dinner.
Mm.
Like it means nothing to him.
And Fincher hides it because there's this kind of screaming whistle through the house.
Yeah.
And then later, when Daniel Craig sneaks into the house, he leaves the door slightly ajar.
Yes.
So you think that moment was foreshadowing for this explains the mechanism by which he will be discovered, right? You're like, oh, okay, that's why there was that weird moment with the like screamy whistling noise of the wind through the house.
Yeah.
It's so that we'd understand how Martin would know that Daniel Craig's character was in the house.
No, my good boy. What Finch has done is he's forced you to empathize with the last moments of a character that you're never going to see, hear, or meet ever. There was nothing but inane sadness that hit me by the truckload, seeing the cage in the background, and it just casually brushed off like it meant nothing. I was like, that was someone's entire struggle.
That was someone's entry in the Saw franchise.
How does a filmmaker have the gall to make me care about these anonymous people that are just Polaroids on a map of where the murders have taken place? And when you find out what you do find out, it's 14 years old, Martin's the killer. Shocker!
I've got a quote from David Fincher.
Go on.
That's relevant to your cage observation.
Yeah.
It's about the scene earlier in the film, which is so difficult to watch. But he says, you walk a line, you know, everything has to move the story forward, but I won't be unhappy if people faint.
Unbelievable. Do you know what I mean? Fincher makes me nervous, man. Yeah. He picked this up and went, I'm going to do it this way. It's a conscious choice. The worst thing about it is, on top of everything, the one thing that really sells to me that Fincher might be a serial killer, Zodiac, Social Network, Seven. Like, do you know what I mean?
Gone Girl.
Gone Girl, we're not there yet. Gone Girl gets to me on a whole different level, and it's 10 times worse than this.
Yeah.
Don't get me started on that, because I'll freak out.
Fine.
But this is what I'm saying. So he's doing some stuff, right? He might be a serial killer.
Yeah.
And he might be doing what the Zodiac's doing, but instead of sending letters to a newspaper,
he's making films.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is what I'm thinking. Is the next David Fincher going to be making a film about a cold case of a director that made a shitload of great movies about serial killers whilst being a serial killer in 20 years' time?
Just coming back for a moment to the cruelty of this film. You're right. It's a very isolating, it's a very lonely film. Except for the fact that our two characters find solace in one another.
It's the most beautiful thing about the film, by a long shot.
Right. Except it doesn't end.
No, it does not.
With them coming together. It ends with Lisbeth riding off, believing that the man that she, her first friend, really, she makes him a custom motorcycle jacket. And what breaks my heart is that the card that she writes Happy Christmas in, the design on the front is like a horse hugging a bunny. Yeah. It's really naive. It's really childlike. It's really like something that she picked because it reminds her of a time when she was last happy, which would have been very young. And then she sees him in the distance, arm in arm with his editor, assumes that they're back together, chucks it in the bin, rides off, roll credits. And that is where these characters, these version of the characters, will stay forever.
Yeah. And that is the most disgusting injustice that I can think of that Hollywood...
Do you know who did that injustice to you?
Who?
Fede Alvarez.
Off. I hate this guy already. My piss is boiling right now. I need you to finish off for why, so it makes sense. Because right. At the moment, I'm just flying. I'm off the handle. Evil Dead's ruined.
So
Aliens ruined.
Right.
The guy he made. Oh my God. He made Don't Breathe. It's awful.
Yeah.
And he ruined this. Sick.
Finch is working away. He's taking his time. It's costing a lot of money. He's got Andrew Kevin Walker in. The studio see this new book, A Girl in the Spider's Web.
Sure.
And they go, do you know what? We're just going to do a soft reboot.
Right.
And so because they skip two books and they start on the first of the next trilogy of the books, because there's four or five books in total.
Okay.
There's the Millennium Trilogy, of which this is the first. And then the book immediately after that was The Girl in the Spider's Web.
Right.
And it's much more upfront, spy thriller. Okay. Kind of, she's using sniper rifles and blah, blah, blah. And it's starring Claire Foy, and it's directed by Fede Alvarez, and it came out, it flopped.
Shocker.
They're never going to come back to this franchise.
Whatever he touches just turns to shit. It's so annoying that everyone's like, what a masterpiece. What a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. He's taken everything that's wrong with The Evil Dead and banged it into a film.
Right.
He's taken all charisma out of it and just done a shitty reboot that literally turns a dog killer into a hero. It's insane that people are buying that and going, yeah, it's a good horror film though, isn't it? It's like, yeah, shit Evil Dead film though, isn't it? And then he has a crack at Alien and he takes the shittiest things we've ever seen on screen and goes, yeah, I'm just going to put all that in one film because why not? Also, inherently scared of guns, xenomorphs, shut up. Of course he's touched this and it's gone to shit. What a shocker.
So what's been killed is not only these characters and their future, you know, screen. We will never see them again. But also that idea that we spoke about in the beginning of that adult franchise, that kind of intelligent, thoughtful, more considered, more complex, interconnected universe with real people going through real things and having real reactions, but as part of a larger franchise.
Yeah. Now everyone's just scared of guns.
So it failed. It fell flat on its face. It was a huge waste of everything.
Shocker.
And here's what Fincher has to say about it. He says, we did it the way that we could. And when people say it cost too much for what the return on investment was, I said, okay, swing and a miss. It's an interesting kind of coming to terms with, like, he's fine with it.
Okay.
He's accepted it. He's just gone, not everything, you can't do everything. He even says, you know, you can't take everything on. That's why when people ask, how does this film fit into my oeuvre? I say, I don't know. I don't think in those terms. If I did, I might become incapacitated by fear.
That's incredibly mature.
And so, right. Okay. So for our many things we tried this year, we're going to do these series and maybe this will be the one that blows up. Mm. Or I'm going to switch job and maybe this one or relationship. Yeah. The person who I think actually speaks on this the best is Trent Reznor.
Okay.
Somebody says, you know, how do you deal with rejection? How do you deal with failure? And he goes, oh, the time old question. Mm-hmm. Most artists will tell you it doesn't matter what others think, and it matters what you think once you finish it. I'd like to say I believe that, but in reality, I can look back on my own work and feel great about something. Then it gets critically shit-canned or someone hates it, and that's the one that sticks with me. I feel like I've failed somebody. The public's reaction to something can often taint your experience, and I try to not put too much weight on that. It does make its way into your process, and particularly in this information-driven world we live in, where everyone's found a way to express their opinion. At the end of the day, what really matters is when you've finished a project, is that feeling of, hey, this is the very best I can do, and I'm proud of it. And I don't think I've let anything out I haven't felt that way about. What the public thinks of it in retrospect and hindsight hasn't always agreed with my opinion, but it has to pass that muster for me to let it out. I know Fincher feels the same way. I know he feels strongly about everything he's done and that he poured his heart and soul into it.
I really like that.
And I'm looking back at our year and I think we've done the same.
Yeah, though. I've been proud of everything we've done this year. We've fallen flat on some things, but we've grown massively in other areas though. Look at you.
Yeah.
You're a different person to who you were a year ago, man. I've never been prouder.
Grim.
That's not grim.
That it's grim. It's too grim a reality. We are sorely out of time.
Guys, thank you so much for hanging out with us. It's been an absolute pleasure. We love each and every one of you incredibly, incredibly so. If you would like to support the show, please feel free to head over to our Patreon. You can start supporting the show for as little as a pound. No pressure to, though. We completely understand. You know, it's that time of year. Finances are tough. Cost of living is going through the roof.
Yeah, I'm with Ben here. I'm with Ben here. That's very, very polite of you, Ben. And yes, by all means, we understand people are poor. But if you're not going to join the Patreon, tell a friend. Share our social media
there
reels. Because otherwise, what are you
doing?
Leave
a review.
You just leave a review.
Hit 5 stars.
Just do something.
You know what I mean?
Just do something. I'm sick of this freeloading. All right? You've come here. You've listened to our show. What are you going to do for us? All right?
This is what it is.
I need some return.
We've done this very transactionally. You know what I mean? There's no unconditional
you
love.
You owe us now. Yeah. You owe us.
We love you with all of our hearts.
Conditionally.
As long as certain criteria are met. Yeah, there you go. That's what we're trying to say.
No, obviously I'm joking. It's been lovely having you. And to thank you for spending an hour of your week with us, especially at the start of the week. We know a lot of you listen on a Monday. Ben is going to wrap up the thoughts, themes, and feelings of this week's movie.
I've got this.
Into a Monday motivational pep talk.
I've got this.
While I just do what I always do and just tell you to consume.
Fincher, I keep saying it, man. Fincher worries me, right? Because as we all know, Fincher's from San Francisco, part of California. And we also know from Fincher's previous filmography, a little clue that he's left in one of his films previously, there is not many basements in California. But hear me out now. Does anyone know if Fincher has a basement? Also now, hear me out. Has anyone decided to check his basement? Because I feel like after the last couple films, it's a warranted check. Just for sort of, you know, just for welfare. Just for welfare. He's a charming fella. He's you know, he's good. Ted Bundy, he was a charming fella. He was good looking. But, and I mean, say what you want about Fritzl. He was a terrible person, but he was a fantastic locksmith. You know what I mean? All of them are good at something. That's what I'm saying.